You must be mistaken, Franny said. I was her problem child. Oh, no. With your red hair and your curiosity, you were perfect to her. She said she knew you would grow up to be a beauty and to be difficult, which I see has come to be true.
Difficult, yes, Franny said,
embarrassed not to have known anything about her mother's true feelings.
Well, we can't really know our parents, can we?
Agnes said, reading her thoughts.
Even for those with the sight, parents are unfathomable creatures.
After the maid came in with tea and bone china cups, Franny took note of a photograph of Vincent on the mantel. He was wearing a white shirt, sitting under a striped umbrella, the blue sky behind him.
When was that taken? She asked.
When he first arrived in Paris. We met in the park.
He was here in autumn. That looks like the height of summer. Madame changed the subject to more current issues. They spoke a little of Halen and his interest in the hospital. Then Madame glanced at her watch. Her car had arrived. It was time to go. Madame Durand walked Franny to the door.
Can I not see him or know where he is? Franny asked.
It's best to let go, she told Franny. That way he stays safe. In truth, it is easier to let your old life disappear in order to start anew. And there's the matter of the curse. Now it can find him either. He has a new name and a new life. Therefore, love is possible.
They were at the door when something overtook Franny, and she simply couldn't leave. Without a word to her hostess, she turned and took the staircase to the second floor. The carpet was plush, cream-colored. The walls were a lacquered red. Off the hallway was a bedroom, and then a sitting room, and then a plush bath tiled with marble. The last door in the hallway was closed. Franny hastily pushed it open, her heart thudding. The room, however, was empty.
"Please, Franny, I have to leave,"
Madame Durand called from the front hall. And then Franny saw it. A guitar, propped up against the bookcase. Madame came up the stairs after Franny. They met in the hallway. She wasn't young, and chasing after Franny was an effort.
"My car is here."
"To take you to the country?"
"Yes."
The yellow flowers. When Franny concentrated, she could see two men walking in the pale sunlight.
"Is that where he is? And William?"
Madame shrugged.
"What do you want me to say? He is not here. You've looked for yourself. He'll never go back, Franny. You must know that."
"That is his guitar, isn't it?" Franny asked. Madame looked at Franny, and Franny could see it was true.
"Do they stay here when in Paris?" she asked.
"Occasionally. Paris wouldn't have suited Vincent in the long run. There are fields of sunflowers out in the country. It's beautiful and peaceful. And you must understand, Franny, he's safe."
"Considering who he is?" Franny said.
"Considering what the world is like."
Franny took a taxi to her hotel and sat looking out the window of her room, watching the darkness fall. She felt Vincent's presence in the world, in the beauty of the evening, and in the sunflowers Madame Durand had had sent over in a glass vase. That was the message, that bouquet, the most Madame would tell her. Franny telephoned Mr. Grant at his home in Sag Harbor. It was early in the morning, but he was glad to hear from her.
"They live in the countryside," she said.
That would be William, to live someplace that reminded him of home. "Do you still get the postcards?" he asked.
"Yes," Franny said. "They're happy," Mr. Grant said.
"So we must be happy for them, dear girl." They made plans for Franny to visit Sag Harbor. She would bring Jet, and they would sit on the porch and have lunch and look out at the sea and the island William used to row toward, even in high seas. She had been in Paris 6 weeks. Soon it would turn cold, and the paths where Franny liked to walk would be covered with ice. In the countryside, the sunflowers would be cut down and their stalks would turn brown.
Birds in the hedges would rise, twittering, to fly over the meadows in the last of the daylight. Yes, she agreed. Let's be happy. Now when Franny came to see Halen, he was no longer in his bed or at physical therapy, but in consultations. The nurses shrugged. A doctor was a doctor, they said. A man's situation might change, but the man himself never did. Such was Halen's character. He was more interested in the well-being of others than he was in himself. One day she took him to the Tuileries on an outing from the hospital. He struggled with his walking at first and called himself a damned peg leg, but by the time they reached a cafe, he had caught a second wind and his stride was fine. His French was impeccable, hers merely good, so Franny let him order for her. They had white wine and salads with goat cheese, and everything was cold and delicious. He spoke about a surgery that had been very successful earlier that day, a sergeant who had taken a bullet to the spine. It was a delicate operation, one Hay excelled at, so the patient had been sent from Germany so that Hay might supervise. He was taking measures to get his French medical license so he would be able to do the surgeries himself. He was excited to be helping servicemen who had lost limbs, as he had. He thought he would use some of his father's money to bring these patients here to France to be treated. He lit up when he spoke of his work, and Franny recalled the way he would speak about science when they were young, the way a lover might speak of his beloved. He poured more wine. It was a perfect afternoon, one Franny would think about often. He would be in the hospital another 6 months. "Just promise me you won't fall in love with anyone else when I go," Franny said. "That's all I'm asking. You can take them home, do whatever you want, sleep with whomever you want. Just don't fall in love." "I never would." "What about Emily Flood?"
"Emily who?"
They laughed and finished their drinks. "What about the nurse?" Halen gave her a look. "Aha," Franny made a face. "She's your type." "You're my type," Halen said. He took her hand and brought it to his mouth so he might kiss her. "You're leaving, aren't you?" "Why? Because you think it's safer for me if we're apart? After everything that's happened to me, do you think I'd give a damn about being safe? I'm coming back to wherever you are." He refused to listen to any arguments against his plan. They walked back to the Rue de Rivoli, where they found a taxi. It was still difficult for Halen to shift his leg into a car. "I'll get better at this," he vowed. Once inside the taxi, Halen drew her to him so that she was on his lap. The driver didn't pay the slightest bit of attention, no matter how heated their kisses became. "We'll outwit the curse," he told her. "Wait and see." Franny liked to sit in the yard wearing her black coat and her old red boots no matter the weather. These days she kept to a schedule. Every morning she wrote a long letter to Halen. She ate the same diet, noodles and apple tart for dessert, or beans and toast and soup. Simple, practical things. She loved the garden, the bats flickering over the pine trees as they devoured insects, the frogs that came to sing in the spring. On most evenings, women arrived in search of remedies. But tonight was different. She spied a girl standing inside the gate. Nearly everyone in town was too afraid to walk into the yard. Even the ones who came to the back porch to knock on the door felt they were taking a risk. They remembered the boys who had been struck by lightning, and the stories their grandparents told about the women who could turn a hare into a snake, and call birds to them, and change the weather if they had a mind to. People still crossed the street when they saw the sisters coming, and at the library no one dared to defy Franny when she made suggestions. The grocery boy who made deliveries wouldn't set foot in the kitchen, even when offered a $10 tip. But here was a girl, utterly unafraid, staring at Franny. She thought it was her neighbor's child at first, the one who was writing her life story in a blue notebook, but as the girl came closer, Franny recognized her. It appeared to be Regina Owens. Franny still had the drawing of the black dog and the cat. It hung in the kitchen in its original frame. The girl resembled Vincent with her long black hair and her confidence. She had bloomed and was a true beauty, but then she would be, considering who her parents were. "You're in California," Franny said. "You can't be here." The girl gazed at her, and Franny was reminded of the time when she saw Isabel on the window seat, or the essence of Isabel at any rate, when their aunt was actually up in her bed. It was a spirit that had come before her, a wisp composed of thought rather than deed.
"My mother will be bitten by a spider. I'll run away with the man I'll marry. You should have told me to stay away from love. Not that I would have listened."
"Well, why don't you listen now?" Franny asked.
"Because I'm not here, silly. Remember, one day you must do as you promised. And then you'll get a big surprise."
"Really? What's that?" The image of Regina had already begun to fade into transparency. It was possible to see right through her to the leaves of the lilacs.
"Wait!" Franny called.
Regina shook her head and smiled, and then there were only the lilacs in the garden, no girl at all. That night, Franny phoned April in California.
"I wondered if you were ever going to call me," April said. "I read about Vincent in the newspaper, and then Jet called me to tell me he was still alive."
"Did she?"
April laughed. "He was always too alive. Anyway, I knew. He sent Regina a record player of all things. And she always gets a box of her favorite cookies from Paris on her birthday. No note, but it's him."
"Were you bitten by a spider?" Franny asked.
"Are you mad? I don't even work with spiders anymore."
"And how is Regina?" Franny wanted to know.
"She's fine. What's all this about?"
"I had a vision, I suppose. Regina was beautiful. She looked like him."
"She does," April said sadly.
For all this time, she had never been in love with anyone else.
"It could have been different."
"No," Franny said. "We were who we were, no more, no less.
He told me we could depend on you."
"Of course."
Talking to April now, Franny wondered why they hadn't been friends all along. Perhaps they were too much alike. Headstrong, willing to do anything for Vincent, refusing to accept certain aspects of their upbringing and their fate. She looked out the window and saw a fleck of white in the garden.
A single rose bloomed. Dusk was falling.
Vincent always said it was the best time of the day, half in one world, half in another.
"Always," Franny said.
Halen came back the following year. He rented a small house near the town green, saying the curse would never be able to figure out where he was, since he slept there on some nights and at Magnolia Street on others. Whenever he came for dinner, he would ask for a salad, since their garden was so marvelous, and of course Franny always obliged. They went out together at dusk. It always smelled the same here, the green scent of weeds and lilacs and rosemary. They had several rows of lettuce, the best in the Commonwealth. Butterhead, red leaf, Boston, loose leaf, curly oak leaf, Red Riding Hood, Escarole. They were both reminded of the evenings when they would meet in the park when they were 16. In all that time, Franny had never loved anyone else. He'd kept his promise and she'd kept hers. They pretended that they meant nothing to each other to keep the curse at bay, but everybody knew the doctor had come here for her. Hay's favorite season was August. He and Franny always swam in Leech Lake, and he never drowned, and Franny never had to rescue him. They didn't wear bathing suits, though he had that leg he had to unhook before hopping in, which could make for precarious going over the flat rocks. All the same, they swam on a daily basis, even though half the town knew and was scandalized. People avoided the place and privately called it Lover's Lake, and rumors grew up around it. A dip in the water could bring the man or woman who'd broken your heart back to you. And some women took to wearing vials of lake water around their necks on a string to ward off evil and bring luck to their families. For several years, Hay commuted to Boston, where he was on the orthopedic surgery team at Mass General, the hospital where he was treated when he was a student. He continued to be on staff and often consulted, but he decided to open a practice, setting up the first floor of his house as an office and hiring a nurse and an assistant. Local women Jet had suggested, as they were clients of hers and in need of jobs. Halen was the only doctor in town, which was a blessing to everyone. When a child was sick, he always made himself available to make a house call. He impressed everyone with his pet crow, and he let well-behaved children feed it a cracker or give it a pat on its gleaming head.
"Shall I tell you a story about a rabbit?" the doctor would say.
And the children would always say yes because they all knew the story by heart. It was the one about a rabbit who had once been a witch. They knew that a witch must never deny who she is, and that no matter what happens, it's always best to be true to oneself. Hay also gave out lollipops, which the children liked, especially when they had scratchy throats, and black bars of soap for their mothers, which were very much appreciated. Folks often saw Dr. Walker leaving the house on Magnolia Street early in the morning, whistling, followed by that old dog of theirs, which had taken a liking to him. Frankly, people wondered what a wonderful man like Halen Walker was doing, associating with the Owens sisters. He was so kind-hearted, after all. He knew everyone's name and all of their ailments, and when walking with Franny to the library for board meetings, he reminded his patients to stop eating salt and take their medications. At night, he came up to Franny's room. After she undressed, he sometimes brushed her hair. He said there had never been a more beautiful color on earth, or a more beautiful woman, even though she knew that if that had ever been true, it wasn't any more, except to him. She always wanted him in her bed, even though he was so tall and took up so much room. Even after all this time, when he kissed her, everything left her mind except for the moment in time they were in, and the heat went through her, slowly, and she fell for him all over again, as if it were the first time. Hay was still a whirlwind, working all hours, though Franny did her best to slow him down. With every step they took, time was passing, spring was ending, summer was gone, ice was covering the window panes. Vincent's old dog passed away, the vines grew taller, Halen's young patients grew up and began to bring their own children to him. Before they knew it, 20 years had gone by. They didn't know how time had moved so quickly, but these were, by far, the best 20 years of their lives. For all that time, they had managed to avoid the curse, meeting at midnight, then sneaking into each other's beds, saying their goodbyes at dawn. "The curse will never find us," Hay always said. "Is that possible?" Franny would then ask. "Isn't that what we've done? We're here together, darling." "You two are like teenagers," Jet teased them when she came upon them kissing in the parlor or the kitchen. "But aren't we still?" Hay said with a grin. "Oh, yes," Franny said. "And you're still refusing to eat a tomato sandwich. And you're still difficult." There was that grin, so how could she be annoyed? Still, she protested.
"I was never difficult."
"No," Hay said, linking his arms around her, pulling her near. "Never once." As most doctors do, Halen diagnosed himself. He had cancer, and he knew enough to know it was too late. He conferred with an old friend at Mass General, a specialist in oncology and hematology, but he already knew what the advice would be. "Live now." He told Franny at the lake, where she wept in his arms. Still, he insisted there was always some good to come out of every circumstance. Now the curse could not touch him. They'd held it off with trickery. He was dying, and nothing more could bring him to ruin. They could finally be husband and wife. It was too late for many things, but it was not too late for that. Jet had been right. Whenever they looked at each other, they saw the people they had first fallen in love with. She was a gawky, beautiful, freckled girl with long red hair, who liked tomato sandwiches for lunch and had shivered when he first kissed her. He was a tall boy who cared more about other people than about himself, one who had almost died of appendicitis at Harvard, and who had refused to stop loving her, no matter what fate decreed. That same afternoon when he told her he was dying, he went out and bought her an engagement ring, an emerald, which some people say is much preferable to a diamond, for it causes love to last. In certain lights it was the gray-green of her eyes, and in full sun it reminded her of the garden, a deep, lush green. Halen went to Jet for her permission to ask Reverend Willard if he would officiate at the service. Jet telephoned the Reverend, who said he would be honored to do so. Halen then went over to his house, and the men drank glasses of whiskey. The Reverend said he liked to get to know the people he would be marrying. It was more personal that way. "We've been together since we were kids, sometimes more so and sometimes less so," Halen told him. The Reverend congratulated Dr. Walker and said he was a lucky man. Franny was waiting for him at home. He walked so slowly now it broke her heart to see it, but she waved and rushed out to meet him. She worried that the Reverend had changed his mind and that Hay would be disappointed, but instead the men had wound up having several drinks. "I told him it was the end of the curse," Halen assured Franny. "At least for us. If we're choosing anything, let's choose love." On the day the doctor married Frances Owens, the whole town came out to stand on the sidewalk and watch through the window of Town Hall, moved by the power of love. Some of the children had never even seen a member of the Owens family, for they weren't allowed to walk down Magnolia Street, and they wondered now why their parents had always been nervous about the tall lady with red hair. The Reverend wore his old black coat and his thin black tie. He had aged greatly and was now quite stooped. His arthritis made it difficult for him to drive, so on Sundays, Jet often picked him up in the station wagon she and Franny had bought, and she would drive the Reverend to the cemetery. They usually brought plastic lawn chairs so they might stay a while, especially in fair weather. When the daffodils were blooming, they brought armfuls along. They remembered Levi better than anyone, and because of this, they often didn't need to speak. Jet still wore the moonstone. She had never once taken it off, not even to bathe. As the wedding service was about to begin, the Reverend nodded to Jet, who was the maid of honor, dressed in a pale green shift. She nodded back, and in that quiet way they shared the grief the feud between their families had caused, as well as the joy of the day. "Unable are the loved to die, for love is immortality," the Reverend quoted when he ended the service. A blessing not only for the husband and wife, but for Jet as well, who understood his meaning in his choice of Emily Dickinson. Levi would always be with them. When the happy couple walked out of Town Hall, there were wild cheers. Franny hadn't even known there were so many people in their town. She hunched down, unused to all the attention. The doctor's patients threw rice, and the children's chorus from the elementary school sang, "All You Need Is Love." Franny carried a bunch of long-stemmed red roses. Hay was slowed down a bit by the problems with his leg and by the pain he was suffering, but he grinned and waved as if he had won a race, his arm around his bride, who was crying too much right there in public to notice much of anything other than how crowded the street was on this day. Even people who had always disliked the Owenses and blamed them for every misfortune in town had to agree that Frances Owens made a beautiful bride, even at her age, even though she dressed in black. Dr. Walker moved into the old house, for he had no fear of curses, just of the pains and suffering of real life, and anyone could tell he was happy. People would see him watering the garden. He weeded between the rows of lettuce while singing to himself. He had to close down his office, but he'd talked a young doctor from Boston into taking over his practice, which was fortunate for him and even more fortunate for the town. These days, Halen wanted to spend as much time as he could with Franny, who liked to tease him about his new gardening mania. He'd put out a wooden box just inside the fence, filled it with lettuce, and urged their neighbors to take as much as they'd like. "The best lettuce in the Commonwealth, if we can keep the rabbits away," he told people passing by. "They're never going to walk through the gate," Franny insisted. And then the oddest thing happened. They did. His patients and her neighbors all came past the gate, and although some appeared to be nervous, they gratefully took the lettuce, heads of all varieties, each so good that people who made salads of the stuff dreamed of rabbits and of their own childhood gardens. Charlie Merrill was now deceased, so Franny had asked his sons to bring over a bench so Hay could sit and rest out on the porch, which he had begun to do. He had slowed down, but not completely. He let Jet water the garden now, and Franny weed, but all that summer he set out lettuce for his friends and patients.
"Aren't I lucky?" he said one evening when he and Franny were sitting on the bench holding hands, watching the dusk sift down.
Hay remembered walking through Central Park, lying on the grass looking at stars, swimming in the cold pond just before he went away. He remembered Franny with her red hair pinned up haphazardly, lying on the floor with him, in the cook's room at her parents' house, naked and beautiful. He tried not to take painkillers because he didn't want to spend any of his time with Franny in a haze.
"I might have drowned long ago, and then we wouldn't have had all of this."
Franny had no idea how it was possible to love him more, but she did. She thought perhaps that was the curse, to love someone so much when you knew he would leave you. But Hay was right.
"We are lucky," she said.
It was all because of third grade, when you walked into the classroom in a black coat looking pissed off. Franny laughed.
"I was not pissed off."
She looked at him.
"Was I?"
"You most certainly were, until I sat next to you." Halen grinned, which undid her, as always. She leaned her head against his chest and wondered how on earth she could ever let him go.
"Was it fate?" she asked.
"Do we care?" he answered.
The truth was, they had managed to get what they wanted. It just wasn't lasting long enough, not that it ever could.
When he passed, the doctor was sitting on the porch on an autumn night. The lilacs were blooming out of season. There were so many stars in the sky, it was impossible to count them all. They had turned off the light on the back porch, the better to see the swirling show above them.
"Oh, how beautiful," was the last thing he said.
There was no warning when it happened, and no pain. He just was there one moment, and then he was gone. Franny sat outside with him all night. She was so cold in the morning that Jet brought her a pair of gloves. Charlie's sons took him to the funeral parlor in their new truck, with Franny insisting she go. She sat in the bed of the pickup with the doctor, who had been covered by a woolen blanket. She did not notice what roads they took or that the sky was piercingly blue. They made sure he was dressed in a black suit, with no shoes on, for that was the way people were buried in their family, in a plain pine coffin. Franny sat in the funeral parlor all night. Near midnight, Jet came with a thermos of tea and a blanket for her sister, and they sat together, not speaking, but holding hands, as they had when they were girls sitting on the roof that first summer they visited Aunt Isabel's house, wondering where life would lead them. The Walkers did not argue or protest Halen's final resting place in the Owens Cemetery. They were all buried in Bedford, New York, but they understood his place was not with them. His family came up to Massachusetts in three long black cars. The Reverend performed the service. It was brief, and allowed time for patients and friends to stand up and say their piece or give a blessing. The youngest speaker was 9. Dr. Walker had cared for him when he had appendicitis, and the speaker, who had been bought his first suit for the occasion, wanted to say that he had decided to become a doctor because of Dr. Walker. Mr. Walker was old by then, and he had lost his only son. His wife had been gone for some time. Even though he was rich and had a new wife, even though Halen had spent a lifetime quarreling with him, Mr. Walker was bereft. Franny made sure Halen's father sat next to her, with Jet on his other side.
It was always you, he said to Franny. That sort of thing doesn't happen very often. It was never going to be Emily Flood. Even I knew that.
Love of my life, Franny thought.
The day Halen was buried was beautiful and clear. The crow was in the tree, old Lewis, who was going blind, his eyes filmy and white. Seeing him broke Franny's heart. The bird cried, even though crows are said not to have tear ducts. Afterward, Franny called Lewis to her and she carried him home, where she wrapped him in a blanket, for he coughed and fretted. He died the following day, and one of the Merrill boys buried him behind the shed. He had never belonged to Franny, and had always preferred Halen, and she'd never once blamed him for that. Franny stayed out on the porch for 7 nights. The vines began to grow over the bench where Halen liked to sit. They grew and grew, until passers-by could no longer see Franny Owens in mourning. The bin where Dr. Walker had offered lettuce to passers-by was empty. Children asked for him when the new doctor in town made a house call. They wanted the story about the rabbit and the kind, tall man who had lollipops in his pockets. People in town pitied Frances Owens, her grief, and many felt bereaved themselves by the loss of such a good man. They brought casseroles and salads, pies and cakes, all of which Jet accepted gratefully. But Franny did not try a bite, and she left it to her sister to send thank you cards. People in town had lost a doctor and a friend. She had lost her life. She looked at the trees, and they grew taller. And the vines covered the fence and the gate, and people stayed away, the way they used to, before Halen Walker came to town. For 7 days, Franny Owens did not brush her hair, or wash her face, or have a meal. The birds in the thickets came to nest in the vines, but she couldn't even hear them sing, and they wouldn't come to her when she held out her hands. She had lost some of who she was when she lost her beloved. Though Jet had draped sheets over the furniture and drawn all of the curtains, Franny couldn't bear to go inside and leave the place where she had last been with her husband. The man Halen had been lingered in the dark. All she wanted was to hold his hand, to see the way he smiled at her. She saw bits and pieces of him out of the corner of her eye, or maybe it was the fireflies. He was a man of integrity, a man of honor. The boy who had chained himself up in the school cafeteria for the rights of others. The doctor who kept lollipops and bars of soap in his pockets, who had helped 500 men learn how to walk, who had known how to make her shiver with a kiss when she was a 17-year-old girl. She had loved one person in her lifetime, and for that she would always be grateful. On the 8th night, she came inside and got into bed beside Jet. She was shivering and still wearing her coat. Halen was gone, and there was nothing she could do about it.
"How will I ever love anyone again?"
she said to her sister.
That was when the telephone rang.
Part 6. Remedy. 30 years after Vincent's disappearance, his granddaughters, aged 3 and 4, lived with their mother and father in a house in California, in a town called Forestville, where the trees were so old and tall it was impossible to see the sky. Regina Owens had grown up to be a beautiful woman with long black hair and gray eyes the color of mist. She had a lovely singing voice and was so graceful, the birds came to watch when she hung the laundry on the line. She knew how to have fun. She didn't believe in drudgery or boredom, and had a trick so that the broom swept all by itself when she cleaned the house. Her daughters, Sally and Jillian, were 13 months apart, as different as chalk from cheese, but best friends all the same. A good thing, for there were no other children for miles. Their world was mossy and green, with rain that splattered down for days on end. The girl's father, Daniel, was a fisherman and a guide on the Russian River. Their mother was a painter whose subject matter was trees, not surprising given their location. The girls liked to climb the trees surrounding their house, and often had tea parties with their stuffed animals aloft, using the branches as the table and chairs. When they concentrated, they could make the wind come out of nowhere and shake the branches, and then they would laugh and hold on for dear life. Sally would open her hands, and birds would come to her as if they'd been called, and Jillian could dangle on the farthest branch and let the wind blow right through her and not be scared at all. The girl's grandmother, April, who had been their favorite person in all the world, had recently and unexpectedly died of a lethal bite from a brown wandering spider that had been hiding in a bunch of bananas brought from a market. They had not eaten fruit since. They had not laughed or climbed trees. They had been in mourning, and their mother especially had been so sad she took to her bed. It was not at all like Regina to be mournful, but sometimes she could be heard crying while she hung the laundry on the line, and now the birds scattered. She spent her birthday under the covers, even though the box from Lotterie Royale that always came to her from Paris on that day had arrived. And the girls knew there would be delicious macarons inside, a treat to be savored. First a pale orange cookie that was apricot, then a green pistachio, then chocolate, of course, then the best of all, pink ones that tasted like roses. Regina brightened up then, as she did when anything came from Paris. Sometimes there was a postcard with a single heart as the message. Once there was a beautiful box of pastels. They had the macarons and a fragrant tea that always made them feel especially brave. "Always choose courage," Regina told her girls. She wasn't worried about Jillian, who loved to walk on a tightrope set up between the trees, but cautious Sally was another story.
"Don't live a little," Regina would whisper to her older daughter when she tucked her in at night. "Live a lot."
Regina had fallen in love with the girl's father when they were students at Berkeley. They'd dropped out to live on the land, and for the first year they'd lived in a shack, sleeping together in one sleeping bag, mad for each other. They were still so in love they hadn't spent a night apart. Sorrow was not in either of their natures. At last their father told their mother that it was high time they had a little vacation. He surprised her with plans for a second honeymoon.
"Regina, my beautiful queen," he said, "let's celebrate our lives."
He kissed her on the mouth and made her laugh, and after that she seemed more like her old self, the one who knew how to have fun, and who always took her daughters outside to dance in the rain. They packed their suitcases, promising to bring home presents and chocolate bars. The girls stood at the window waving, and they watched their parents dance on the lawn before they waved back and headed off for their trip. But something had gone wrong. That much was evident. The girls were woken in the middle of the night by their babysitter, a teenager who had become so hysterical the sisters couldn't make out a word she said. They clutched each other and tried to make sense of the babysitter's ramblings. She mentioned a phone call from the sheriff, and then she talked about fire and water, which they knew never mixed. She called them poor, pathetic creatures and wondered what would happen to them now. As the babysitter considered their future, her despair set her into fits of uncontrollable weeping. It was pouring, buckets of cold, stinging rain. No one could dance in this sort of weather. The trees were shuddering without the sisters willing them to do so. Leaves fell like a black blanket. Birds that always gathered at Sally's window disappeared. The girls waited for their babysitter to catch her breath and stop crying. They had never been up in the middle of the night, and they knew bad luck when it came to them. It tapped on the door, quietly at first. Then it pounded, insisting on being let in. Jillian, fair and usually fearless, clutched her stuffed bear and stood in a corner, terror creeping up her spine. Sally, dark and serious, sat on the bed and held the babysitter's hand to calm her. This was the moment Sally had been dreading, when the life they had enjoyed was turned upside down. Her grandmother had confided that it happened to everyone sooner or later. Sally had always thought it would be later, but as it turned out, it was now. Their parents had taken a canoe down the Russian River, loaded down with their father's fishing equipment and their mother's paints and canvases and the pastels that had been sent from Paris. When the rains commenced, suddenly and without warning, the canoe overturned. Daniel nearly went under in the rushing tide, but he managed to hang on to the hull of the boat. Their mother, so buoyant she could not be drowned, floated alongside him, saying encouraging words so he wouldn't give up. When they at last made it to shore, they were grateful for their luck. There was a small motel, and they checked in to wait out the storm, but they must have dozed off, and they didn't hear the storm worsen. When lightning struck the building, they were tangled together in bed, deeply asleep, not recognizing that there were curses in this world, and they were still there, their arms around each other, when the fire began, with smoke filtering through the walls of their room. The babysitter informed the girls that the sheriff's office would soon be sending someone over. Since there was no family, the sisters would be taken into protective custody.
"They'll find you someplace to live. It might not be together, but you won't be alone."
"But where will Mommy and Daddy be?"
Jillian asked. Her voice trembled and her eyes brimmed with tears.
"When are they coming home?"
Jillian said. Sally had very dark gray eyes and a somber expression.
"Don't you get it?" she said to her sister. "They're not."
"That's impossible,"
Jillian said.
"We have to have parents."
Sally turned to the babysitter. She was the take-charge sister, and in this moment it was clear that she had better begin to do so.
"Can you make a phone call?"
The babysitter covered her puffy eyes with a damp cloth and said,
"Maybe later. I'm too upset right now."
Sally stood up, took hold of Jillian's hand, and led her into the parlor.
"No one is splitting us up."
She went to the telephone and opened her mother's date book. She quickly began to page through it. Fortunately, she knew how to read. She remembered an enormous bouquet of wildflowers from Massachusetts had been sent to their grandmother's funeral. The card had been signed, "With love from Bridget and Francis Owens." That meant they were family.
"What are you looking for?"
Jillian wanted to know. The girls were in their pajamas and their feet were bare. They both had a shivery feeling.
"Granny said that if anything ever happened, I should call our family."
"We have a family?"
Sally brought the phone to the babysitter, still reclining on the couch, and had her dial.
"Go pack," Sally whispered to Jillian as she took hold of the phone. "Get our best dresses, the ones Granny bought us."
"What about everything in our room?"
Sally shook her head. They would be traveling light from now on.
"You can take Arthur and Pip."
Jillian stuffed Bear in her toy mouse.
"I'll take Maxine."
Sally stuffed Black Dog. Sally waited for someone to answer. The person who picked up turned out to be a mean old lady.
"Do you know what time it is?"
said the annoyed voice on the line.
"I can't tell time," Sally admitted.
"Who is this?"
"Sally Owens, who is this?"
"Francis Owens," the old woman said, sounding surprised.
"You sent the flowers. My grandmother said to call our family if anything happened."
There was a pause.
"And did it?"
A police cruiser was pulling into the driveway. The headlights were so bright, Sally shielded her eyes. When the lights were turned off, Sally blinked. She would have to tell the people at the funeral parlor that her parents should be dressed in black with no shoes. That was the way their grandmother had been buried. She and Jillian would wear their best dresses and, out of respect, be shoeless as well.
"Oh, thank God,"
Sally heard the babysitter say when the officers knocked on the door. Sally held the phone receiver tightly.
"We are coming to live with you,"
she said to the mean old lady. At least she and Jillian would be together. Jillian had returned, dragging along their party dresses. Hers was violet, and Sally's was pink, trimmed with lace.
"Good,"
Sally said.
"Those are the right ones."
"What are you saying?"
the woman on the phone asked in an upset tone.
"What happened?"
The officers approached the girls solemnly. They'd taken off their hats, and one policeman got down on one knee so he could talk to the sisters at eye level.
"I think you need to hang up the phone, little girl," he said.
"Oh, no,"
Sally answered. She handed the receiver to him.
"This is our aunt. She'll make all the arrangements for us to go and live with her."
The plane ride was their first, and it was horrible. There was a storm over the middle of the country with lightning streaking the sky, which terrified both girls.
"Lightning never strikes twice,"
Sally said firmly to reassure both herself and her sister. All the same, Jillian vomited twice into a paper bag that Sally then handed to the flight attendant. They were in their flimsy party dresses, and they both had small leather suitcases under their feet. Sally had taken along practical things, toothbrushes and toothpaste, photographs of their parents, a comb, pajamas and slippers. Jillian had stuffed in all of her other party dresses, so many that her suitcase barely shut.
"Don't you girls have anything warm to wear?"
the flight attendant asked when they were finally landing.
"It's Boston, after all. There could be snow."
Neither girl had ever seen snow. For a moment, they were excited as they peered out the window and spied huge white flakes.
"Oh, Arthur,"
Jillian said to her stuffed animal,
"I think you're going to like it here."
Sally sat back in her seat, worried. It was dark in Boston, and the snow was swirling, and their parents weren't coming back, and the old lady she'd spoken to had been mean. The flight attendant walked them off the plane and through the terminal. It was already cold, and they weren't yet outside. Ice coated the window panes. People spoke loudly in rough voices. Someone said it was wicked nasty out tonight. The sisters held hands. They didn't like the sound of that.
"I actually don't think Arthur's going to like it here," Jillian muttered in a dark voice.
"Of course he will. Where do you think bears come from?"
Sally said primly. She herself was shivering.
"They like cold climates."
"There aren't bears in California,"
Jillian protested.
"Daddy said he saw one."
"I think that's your family,"
the flight attendant said, pointing. The sisters turned quickly to look. There were two women in black coats, one very tall and the other shorter with snow-white hair. They both had red balloons tied to their wrists so the girls would see them. The shorter one carried a black cane with a carved raven's head. She waved and called out their names. Sally and Jillian stopped, frozen in place. This most assuredly could not be their family.
"I don't like them,"
Jillian said.
"You don't even know them,"
Sally said reasonably.
"I don't want to,"
Jillian's voice sounded the way it always did before she began to cry.
"They're old."
"Granny was old."
"No, she wasn't. She was beautiful. That's why her name was April."
"Let's go, girls," the flight attendant urged.
They had reached the arrivals gate. What was done was done. What was to begin was on the other side of the gate. They could run, but to where? The police were in California, and they'd be split in two and given to people who wouldn't care if Jillian was afraid of the dark, and Sally liked to eat the same thing for breakfast every day, oatmeal topped by a spoonful of honey. The girls looked at each other, then approached their aunts.
"There you are!"
The one who said she was Aunt Jet cried cheerfully.
"Aren't you opposites? I think I'll call you night and day. You're late, but a late start means an ending that will be right on time."
The aunts smelled like lavender and sulfur. They wore boots and gloves and knitted scarves, and they'd brought along scratchy black wool coats for the sisters. When the girls put them on, it felt as if spiders were crawling up their arms and backs. And the girls didn't like the idea of spiders at all.
"What did I tell you?"
the tall one, Franny, said to the nice one.
"People in California dress like fools."
"No, we don't,"
Sally said, insulted. This tall aunt was clearly the mean one. She appraised Sally coolly.
"You're not a troublemaker, are you?" she asked.
"She's not at all,"
Jillian said protectively.
Then I suppose you are,
Aunt Frances said to the younger girl.
What if I am?
Jillian said, her hands on her hips.
Then you'll bring trouble upon yourself, which I'd hate to see.
Jillian's eyes widened. She was seconds away from tears.
Well, you're probably blind and couldn't see it anyway,
Sally said in an effort to defend her sister.
I am not blind or deaf, and if you have any sense, you'll listen to what I say,
Franny advised.
I will always have your best interests at heart.
We'd better go, Jet said, having had enough of the squabbling.
There's snow.
Flakes were falling as they walked through the parking lot to a battered Ford station wagon. Aunt Frances took the car key and burst the balloon that was tied to her wrist. The pop made Jilly put her hands over her ears.
Really, Franny, Jet said. Must you? Well, it wouldn't have fit into the car.
Franny popped Jet's balloon as well. Then, feeling some remorse because their nieces looked so nervous, she stuck her hands in her pockets and brought out red licorice and gumballs for the girls to suck on during the long drive from the airport.
I suppose this is what children like, she said. I always preferred lemon slices.
The flight had been a red-eye, and dawn was breaking as they turned onto Main Street. The snow had accumulated, and it was slow going. There were crows perched on the rooftops of many of the houses and almost no stores on Main Street. A pharmacy, a bakery, a grocery store. As they drove past, the streetlights flared, then went out. All at once, they had reached their destination. In the back seat of the station wagon, the girls were still holding hands. When they got out, their shoes became soaked with snow.
Of course, Franny said, no boots. People in California probably don't believe in them.
They walked up the path to the Owens house. Sparrows were nesting in the twisted wisteria. When Sally held out her hand, one flitted over to sit in the center of her palm.
Hello,
she said, comforted by the warmth of the bird and its bright eyes.
How unusual,
Jet said, tossing a knowing look at Franny. Another Owens, to whom birds flocked of their own accord.
It always happens, Jillian said proudly. She doesn't even have to whistle.
Really? Franny said.
Then she's clearly a very talented girl.
There were so many vines the girls could barely see the door. The garden had been put to bed for the winter, with some of the shrubs wrapped in burlap, which made them look like monsters. The wisteria twisted around the pillars of the porch like a goblin's fingers. The house itself was tall and tilty, with green glass in the windows and a fence that circled the property like a snake. Jillian was not a fan of snakes, or vines, or trees that looked like monsters, but Aunt Jet offered her hand and said, "I have something special for you for breakfast."
Is it macarons? That was our mother's favorite. She always got a box sent from Paris on her birthday.
Jet and Franny exchanged a look.
Did she?
Jet said. Well, this time it's chocolate cake. The best you'll ever have. And we have Dr. Pepper if you're thirsty. They went up to the porch as if they'd known each other for years. That left Sally and Aunt Frances standing on the path.
Do you live here all alone? Sally asked.
Of course not. Your Aunt Jet is here.
You don't have a husband?
I did. Once.
Sally stared at her aunt.
I'm sorry, she said.
Franny stared back, a bit shaken at having been asked about Halen. Hay would have been so much better with children. If they'd ever had their own, she'd be a grandmother by now. She would be different then, softer, not so quick to frighten small children.
I'm sorry about what happened to your parents, Franny managed to say. I knew your mother when she was a little girl.
I still have one of the pictures she drew when she visited me. I have it right in the front parlor. Sally looked up at Aunt Frances, waiting to see what she would say next.
I was a friend of your grandmother's, you know, and your grandfather.
I miss him every day, Franny said, before thinking better of it.
We didn't have a grandfather,
Sally said, despite her inner vow not to give out any information.
You did, but he went away to live happily ever after in France.
Franny gave the girl a closer look.
You resemble him. You're lucky in that.
If all that was true, he'd have had a name.
Sally was stubborn and not afraid to talk back. Her chin was raised, as if she were ready to have Franny say something terrible. All at once, Franny felt something she'd never felt before. She felt another person's loss.
He has a name, Franny said.
She sounded different when she spoke. Sadder. Not mean at all.
Vincent.
I like that name, Sally said.
Why wouldn't you? Franny said. It's a wonderful name.
If he's living happily ever after, you shouldn't sound so sad, Sally told her aunt.
You're absolutely right.
Is he the one who sends the cookies? Sally asked. The ones made of roses from Paris?
Franny looked into Sally's clear gray eyes. It was an honest, innocent question. She felt a surge of relief, but also a swell of sorrow for all of the years that had been lost.
Yes, I'm sure he is.
Will he ever come back?
Franny shook her head.
Unlikely.
Sally thought it over and took her aunt's hand.
What's this about? Franny said, surprised.
Vincent, what will happen when he sends the macarons to California? He'll worry about us.
When they're sent back to Paris, he'll know you live here, with us, and he won't worry.
Standing on the porch where the light was always turned on, Sally felt her aunt's loss as well. Franny lowered her gaze so that the girl wouldn't see tears in her eyes. She thought children were better behaved if they had a little fear and respect. But rules were never the point. It was finding out who you were. In the kitchen, there was a chocolate tipsy cake for breakfast. The girls might as well learn early on, this was not a house like any other. No one would care how late they stayed up at night, or how many books they read on rainy afternoons, or if they jumped into Leech Lake from the highest cliff. All the same, there were some things they needed to learn. Do not drink milk after a thunderstorm, for it will certainly be sour. Always leave out seed for the birds when the first snow falls. Wash your hair with rosemary. Drink lavender tea when you cannot sleep. Know that the only remedy for love is to love more.
The Rules of Magic was written by Alice Hoffman and read by Marin Ireland. It was recorded at John Marshall Media in New York. Editing, mix, and post-production by Glynn Corporated. Tiffany Ferrari and Aaron Larson were the associate producers. The Rules of Magic was produced by Erica Weintraub and directed by Nicole Shelton. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Rules of Magic is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Practical Magic. Written by Alice Hoffman and read by Christina Moore. And Faithful, a novel, written by Alice Hoffman and read by Amber Tamblyn.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.